creator, then we come to the next question. Such a wise creator, what was his purpose for creating the world, for creating the human beings? And then we have this question of the philosophy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala creating the human beings. Is it without any purpose? It is against the wisdom of such creator that even they are introducing to us. So then we go to the philosophy of creation, and the following discussions are, for example, it is for guiding the human beings, and Allah needs to send some prophets to guide these human beings. The point is that if this creator is a wise creator, then he is going to have contact with his creatures.
He would not leave them alone. I created you and do your own thing.
Yeah, and that is why he is sending the prophets to guide the people. He is sending the revelations. And sending revelation means that God has a kind of relation to this world. We cannot claim that God has forsaken the whole world. The world is working on its own, but some people call prophets, they are receiving revelation from nowhere. This is meaningless. So my point is that if we accept that a wise creator has created the world, then we need to go and answer the following question. Then what was his wisdom behind creating this world?
Right.
The wisdom, if we come to this conclusion, that his wisdom was guiding the people, and the other philosophies mentioned for that, then it means that we as human beings are in need of contact relationship to this creator. This creator, this wise creator, should send us guides through the prophets, and so on and so forth.
And disregarding the need of creations to the creator to function and live and exist, if we just solely look on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, on the creator, the architect, we say that he is wise. A wise person, no, we're not even talking about the creator, the most wisest being. We're talking like a person who has a pet. He has a bird, for example, and he wanna go traveling for 2 months, 3 months. He's not going to leave this bird alone. It will die. It cannot function. He maybe gives it a lot of water, a lot of food, and maybe no, he even gives it to another person to safekeep. He's not going to leave it alone, because that, one, would be unwise of him, and two, if you like your pet so much, you're compassionate, you're caring, you're not going to let it alone, leave it alone, let it die. It makes no sense.
Very beautiful. And the next point is that, again, if you're talking about that wise creator, our question is that which God are you talking about? Is it the God of Judaism, Christianity, Islam? It doesn't make any difference. In all these divine religions, God has talked to human beings. And God has asked, not to put it this way, God has encouraged the servants to talk to him, to supplicate.
He wants them to supplicate. Talk to me, I will help you.
Basically. I will help you. So how can we claim that God has forsaken the world, but he has encouraged the people, Jewish people, Christians, Muslims, that be in contact with me? Which God? If he has forsaken the world, why he's asking and is encouraging the servants to be in contact with him?
Right.
So the God which has been introduced, at least in divine religions, is the God who is in constant contact and relation with the people. He is sending prophets to guide the people, and people talk to him, pray to him, supplicate to him, and people are in need of constant relationship with their Lord.
Exactly.
The next point is that one of the philosophies that are mentioned for the need of human being for God is that in many cases people they come to this conclusion that this world is meaningless without a God. So for example, the Quran mentions the example of those people who are in a ship and they are close to be drowned. Now they remember God, and many people in other afflictions, it may happen to them that when there is no other human beings to help them, they feel that there is someone, some being.
They may not call it God or Allah, but they feel that there is something entirely else that can help.
That can help him. Now the question is that if this feeling is true, which is the case, then if God has forsaken the world, then how you are able to explain this need and this feeling? So if all the human beings under such conditions, they come to this conclusion that someone can help them, if that being has forsaken the world, then it is a fake need and feeling. And of course, if we want to put it philosophically speaking, there are many philosophical arguments to reject that. We know that all the creatures, they are hadith, meaning they are created in time, they are contingent, philosophically speaking, which means that in every moment of their existence, they are in need of the creator. But I think the answers which we are given are enough, but for more philosophical arguments, the dear listeners can refer to the books of philosophy, especially the Islamic philosophy.
And as an additional note, dear listeners, dear Muslim listeners, you can also refer to Surah Al-Baqarah, verse 186 of the Holy Quran, where God is speaking to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, where he's saying, وَإِذَا سَأَلَكَ عَبَادِ عَنِّي فَإِنِّي قَرِيبٌ.
MashaAllah.
If my servants ask you, O Prophet, about me, tell them I am near them. أُجِيبُ دَعْوَةَ الدَّاعِ إِذَا دَعَانِ. I answer the supplication, the prayer, the need of the supplicator if he asks me. فَلْيَسْتَجِيبُوا لِي وَلْيُؤْمِنُوا لِي لَعَلَّهُمْ يَرْشَدُونَ. Thus let them obey me and I shall answer them with the hope that they may be victorious in the hereafter, inshallah. Mm-hmm. Dear Sheikh, this discussion has been very fruitful,
Alhamdulillah.
But we must end it, unfortunately. Dear listeners, this has been your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, coming to you from your program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting, of course, as usual, from IRIB English Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
إن في الجنة نهرا لبن علي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن علي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب آل البيت فرض عندنا حب آل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لنا شميحا
Around the World with Reporters.
Pakistan's President, Foreign Minister and others joined this rally in support of the people of Kashmir. The rallies were held in Pakistan to mark the second anniversary of India's, what Pakistan says, illegal move to revoke the special status of the disputed Kashmir region. India on August 5, 2019 abrogated the Article 370 of the Indian Constitution that granted special status to the Jammu and Kashmir region. Pakistan rejected the move as a violation of the UN Security Council resolutions that seek a referendum to decide the final status of Jammu and Kashmir.
I want to assure my Kashmiri brothers that Pakistan will continue to support the people of Kashmir for their right to self-determination. We will continue to support Kashmiris till they get freedom.
Go India, go back!
Separately, Kashmiri leaders also took to the streets in Islamabad. The All Parties Hurriyat Conference staged a protest not far from the Indian High Commission in Islamabad.
We, the Kashmiris, not only in occupied Kashmir, Azad Kashmir, or in Pakistan, but over the world, where the Kashmiris are present, they are making this day as a black day. Why we are making this day as a black day? Because against the will and wish of the people of the Kashmir, India has abrogated its articles.
Protesters condemned the Indian policy towards Kashmir and vowed to continue their struggle until Kashmiris get their right to self-determination.
Kashmir is a disputed territory as per the United Nations resolutions.
the resolutions have been passed, and at the behest of the India, it was India who took the Kashmir dispute to the United Nations, and it is India. It is the then Prime Minister of India, Jawaharlal Nehru, who in his communique to Pakistan said, we do not believe in forced marriages, and Kashmiris will be given right to self-determination.
Kashmir remains at the heart of tensions between India and Pakistan. The dispute dates back to the partition of the subcontinent in 1947. Both countries have fought wars over the only Muslim-majority state controlled by India.
Tensions between India and Pakistan have further deepened since India revoked the special status of Kashmir. Pakistan insists India has to reverse the changes for any talks. India, however, is defending the changes, calling it as its internal matter, and hence the deadlock. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
The brutal battle between Taliban and government forces has intensified recently, with each side struggling to gain more area under their control. Top military officials in southern Helmand province have urged the residents of the city of Lashkargah to evacuate their houses. Reports say Afghan forces are planning to launch a heavy attack on Taliban inside the city of Lashkargah, who use residences of locals as human shields.
We had announced that if a single Talib arrives in Lashkargah city, he will be killed. Even if 1,000 of them arrive, we will kill them all. This fight is not ours. They are Takfiris and slaves of Punjabis. They aren't Afghans. Our fight against them is a pure jihad, and we will continue this holy jihad with a strong will.
Taliban has in recent weeks launched more attacks on provincial capitals, mainly in southern and western Afghanistan. This comes as many have believed neither the government nor the Taliban will achieve their goals to take full control of the country via insisting on further war. They say negotiation is the only solution to resolve the conflicts.
Today, the ancient city of Herat is under attack, and the war has reached inside people's houses in Lashkargah of Helmand. Meanwhile, violence is spreading across the northern Taliban city and other areas. We still hope to reach peace through responsible moves by the government and Taliban.
Based on official figures, over 1,000 Taliban militants have lost their lives in a series of attacks carried out by Afghan air and ground forces backed by local armed fronts since last week. Afghan forces increased their attacks on Taliban militants and liberated some of lost areas, including Nijrab and Talaobarfak districts in northern and northeastern Afghanistan. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani recently called on the entire nation to establish a united national resistance front against the Taliban. He argues that since the Taliban have put military victory on the top of its priorities list, the time has come to talk to militants with guns and resistance. Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
British Muslim advocacy group CAGE is preparing to go to war with the British government after announcing a legal bid against Education Minister Gavin Williamson over what they call discriminatory guidance to school leaders on Palestine. CAGE say the letter issued by Williamson on May the 28th amounted to a disgraceful censorship of political dissent in schools and discriminated against students by infringing their rights to freedom of expression.
CAGE has seen nearly 50 cases of people, of students, who have been targeted in their schools for speaking openly about Palestine and defending the rights of the Palestinian people to defend themselves against a system of apartheid and oppression and occupation.
The government's crackdown on Palestine solidarity in UK schools occurred during the huge global outrage over Israel's relentless attacks against worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and civilians in Gaza last May. Williamson's letter warned teachers to remain impartial on the conflict, but also warned of concerning rise in anti-Semitic incidents. However, CAGE believe this is censorship cloaked by bogus accusations of anti-Semitism.
It is definitely becoming more the case that speaking on the issue of Palestine, advocating for the rights of the Palestinian people, exposing the crimes of the Israeli apartheid regime, these are becoming increasingly issues which are criminalized, issues which are securitized, dealt with very punitive measures, whether in schools, whether in public spaces, or the debate about it is completely hounded out of the public space, such that these issues are silenced and they are unheard.
Cage are confident of success as they believe that the government's position on this topic won't hold water if confronted in the courts. And many people are hoping for success here, as the way things are going now, many critics claim and fear that it could become essentially illegal to support the Palestinian cause publicly in the not-too-distant future unless court battles like this are won now. Robert Carter, London.
Thousands of Lebanese commemorated the first anniversary of the catastrophic explosion which rocked Beirut. Accountability and justice was the main demand of the families of the martyrs.
August 4 should turn into a historic day by holding criminals accountable. The criminals who brought the ammonium nitrate to the port, they killed our children. I lost my only son because of their corruption.
I lost my brother in the blast and lost my mother only 2 months later. She died because of her grief for her son. I want justice for the sake of my brother and my mother. We want justice and we want to see everyone connected with the crime being put on trial.
On August 4th, 2020, a stockpile of ammonium nitrate fertilizer, which was stored without prudence, exploded, becoming one of the largest non-nuclear blasts in modern history, leaving over 200 people killed and thousands injured. The state of mourning for those who fell on the Beirut port explosion is still well alive in the hearts and minds of the Lebanese people, yet justice for the victims still seems out of sight. Yet mourning rallies quickly turned violent after some protesters tried to break into the parliament building. Security forces fired water cannon and tear gas at stone-throwing protesters. Several people were injured. In parallel with the protests, a virtual conference was held in support of Lebanon, where Lebanese President Michel Aoun said the quest for truth and full justice is still the main claim of every Lebanese.
I have already committed before the Lebanese to serve justice and hold accountable everyone whose involvement is proven by the investigation. Today, I restate my pledge that no one is above the law, no matter how high they may rank. Let justice go all the way in probe and the trials.
Aoun stressed that the funds given to Lebanon from the International Monetary Fund must be spent in the best way to face the collapse and embark on reforms, one of which is forensic auditing. She highlighted as very significant. This event comes as Lebanese officials are yet to form a cabinet. Demonstrators' anger is not only at the injustice in the Beirut port case, but at the ineffectiveness of the political class in dealing with the crisis. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Ebrahim Raisi was sworn into office as Iran's new president, prospect of change and resolutions to make Iran a better place to live. 115 heads of state and political officials from 73 countries attended the inauguration ceremony held in Iran's parliament on Thursday. With Judiciary Chief Ghulam Hossein Mohseni Eji on his side, Raisi pledged to protect the constitution and to serve the country and the Islamic establishment.
I, as president, swear to God Almighty before the Holy Quran and before the Iranian nation that I will safeguard the country's official religion and the establishment of the Islamic Republic and the country's constitution.
Ebrahim Raisi won the 13th presidential election on June 18th with a landslide, garnering 64% of the votes. His predecessor, Hassan Rouhani, left office with a pile of unresolved political and economic issues on the table, from snowballing inflation rates to the unconcluded nuclear talks with world powers. The 8th Iranian president vowed to fix all those issues, but he said it will not tie the country's economy to the nuclear deal.
Sanctions against the Iranian nation must be lifted. I will support any diplomatic process that would fulfill this goal. Meanwhile, the Islamic Republic of Iran regards its neighboring countries as its kin. So, our first and foremost priority will be to upgrade our ties with our neighbors.
As has been the custom for any incoming administration, Raisi was endorsed by Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei on Tuesday. Now, after taking the oath of office, Raisi will have to name his cabinet members, who will then show up here in Majlis for a vote of confidence from lawmakers. Coming from the Persepolis camp, Ebrahim Raisi holds different, if not opposing, views compared to his pro-reformist predecessor, Hassan Rouhani. So something like clinching a deal with the U.S. as the ultimate way out for Iran's ailing economy is not expected to be on top of his agenda. As the new president says, he will find new destinations to fix the economy. Yusuf Jalali from the Iranian parliament in Tehran.
Since the armed resistance against Indian rule began in Kashmir in 1989, New Delhi imposed a ban on Muharram processions in Indian-administered Kashmir, reasoning these processions might be used by the pro-freedom outfits to instigate the anti-India sentiments. Despite being challenged in the court of law, the ban remained intact. However, in a surprising move, New Delhi's administration this year lifted the ban. But more than appreciation, this decision has received criticism. Aga Said Rahula Mehdi, former member of Kashmir's Legislative Assembly in the past, has often contested the government's ban on Muharram processions. Mehdi says each time security agencies would give negative feedback.
While you have called off Amarnath Yatra, for which you mobilize entire security grid of the nation to enable that, and at the same time you didn't allow the Eid prayers for the last couple of years and this year including. And the best example to give is the Friday prayers at Central Jama Masjid, the central mosque of Grand Old Mosque of Srinagar. And it has been more than 100 Fridays that the prayers were not allowed or not allowed in that mosque. And while all this is happening, all of a sudden in isolation, you give a permission to a procession for which you denied the permission for 30 years. So to me, it is more questionable than it answers. And I have suspicions.
Mehdi says this decision by New Delhi has more to do with building a fake narrative and dividing the people of Kashmir on the communal lines.
I do not want the other section of the society to be suspicious about this section of the society, that they have the patronage of New Delhi, that they have the patronage of BJP government. If we suffer through it collectively, if we find ways to fight against it, to come out of it, we find the ways and go on those ways collectively. I do not want to see 10th Muharram procession after the gap of 30 years suddenly come up as a procession not for Imam Hussein but for the narrative building of a fake normalcy for Narendra Modi.
Locals too are apprehensive of this move amid the coronavirus pandemic.
Let them not play politics on this at least. This is a religious matter. If they think that allowing this procession will portray normalcy, they are risking lives. I don't think this was the right time to lift the ban. This simply means they don't care for the people.
After facing huge criticism, the government has revised the decision and passed the ball into the local administration's court. Since the decision of whether the Muharram procession be allowed or not has to be taken by district administrations, it remains to be seen how well they stage and whether people participate or not. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Few hours after President Qais Saied's decisions were published in the official gazette, Tunisian security forces arrested lawmaker Yassin Ayari to serve a two-month jail term handed down to him by a military court in 2018.
Everyone who erred must be held accountable, but a civilian may not be tried in a military court. Everyone who committed a crime must be arrested regardless of the circumstances of the trial.
Judge Bashir Al-Akrami was placed under house arrest after being accused of covering up terror-related files, obstructing investigations into them, and violating the law regarding the files of political assassinations. Hours later, security forces raided homes of other lawmakers to implement rulings issued by the military judiciary, including Muhammad Al-Afis, Saif al-Din Makhlouf, Abdul Latif Al-Alwi, and Maher Zaid, who was arrested and then released.
May God bless the president. We thank Qais Saied. We thank him for the decisions. Poverty and unemployment have overwhelmed us. I'm a Tunisian woman begging for money to buy medicine, and even my husband's salary has been seized.
About lifting the immunity of the deputies, I neither agree to nor oppose the decision. I support the enforcement of law.
On August 2nd, Tunisian security forces arrested Member of Parliament Faisal Tibini under summons issued by the first instance court in the state of Jandouba. Tibini was charged with spreading false news and offending others through social media. He also faces three other similar charges. Raids and arrested lawmakers to implement rulings issued by the military judiciary have opened the door to accusations against Saied, while leading political parties in Tunisia accuse the president of orchestrating a coup. Rights activists are concerned that the measures could open the door to further violations of citizens' freedoms.
Raids, arrests, and placing a deputy in prison to implement a ruling issued by the military judiciary opened the door to accusations against Saied, leading political parties in Tunisia accuse him of a coup. Amir Bouka, Tunis.
Following the latest Israeli escalation over the Gaza Strip that left more than 200 people dead, including women and children, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are still recovering the psychological consequences of the war. Almost 600,000 students have suffered a significant learning loss. In conjunction with the announcement of the Palestinian high school Tawjihi scores, 18 students from Gaza are not around to receive their scores as they were killed by the Israeli airstrikes. Khalid Al-Qanoua, a Palestinian student who was supposed to be receiving his high school scores this year, was killed by the Israeli airstrikes, leaving his family grieving.
I remembered Khalid today when I saw other students. Khalid was supposed to be with us today, celebrating his success and distributing sweets like other people. I saw Khalid's mates when they were having their exams, and I felt happy that Palestinians still insist on living their life even after wars and losses. I wish Khalid was here, but I believe that by knowledge, Palestinians will take revenge for Khalid, and his death won't go in vain.
The release of the test scores is usually met with parties, fireworks, and gifts, but due to the crisis in Gaza, many Palestinian students are not celebrating their success.
I have three of my sons who finished high school, and we celebrated with them. There were always atmospheres of happiness when my son succeeded. I wish Khalid was here so we could celebrate with him. He would have been something important. This time, the Israeli occupation stole my happiness. I feel his loss in all ceremonies. Whatever the Israeli regime does with its crimes and killings, we will remain patient, and we won't give up this land.
Subhi Abu Lauf, who has lost most of his family members in the Israeli airstrikes, is also among the students who were deprived from pursuing high school, as he is traumatized by his loss.
Those are really hard times for me while students are happy for their success, being around their families. I've lost my mom, my sister, and my home, and I couldn't continue going to school. There is no place for happiness. My cousin and I were supposed to be celebrating like our mates, but Tawfiq and my family are not around, and I'm not capable of continuing my education.
Many Palestinian students in the Gaza Strip who have lost their homes and family members are not able to carry on with their test for the time being due to the state of depression and instability they are in following the war over Gaza. Roba Shavit, Gaza.
این چیزی که انسان را
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
I invite you to listen to a short part of the book Sirr al-Salat, The Secret of Prayer, written by Imam Khomeini. Some discipline and secrets of takbirs and the eradication of hands. What about the holy man's prayer, as it was said before, after eradicating the veil another manifestation will occur in their hearts? Then they say and call takbir, and through which eradicate that veil, it goes the same up to the seventh stage, which they eradicated to reach the ultimate union stage of blessing. And thus, when the essential manifestation occurs upon their heart without restrictive and without veil, lo, I have turned my face towards him who created the heavens and the earth as one by nature upright, and I am not of the idolaters.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Today we are with another saying of Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini has said that those who have malicious view of Islam are those who have no understanding of Islam. Islam calls towards the peace, and that is what Islam is all about. So these people who have such we can say like views about Islam, the negative views, they never read Islam. They never know about it. They never read Islam. They never tried to understand what is Islam is. Or maybe there must be another thing about them. And that is, if they know Islam very well, they might be the people of evil, the supporters of evil. Because, you know, there is always a war, again, like between the right and wrong. And those who are wrong, they don't want the right ones to win. Because if Islam wins, then there will be a justice amongst the people.
Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum.
If Islam wins, then there will be a justice amongst the people. Then there will be an equal and just division of resources amongst the people. The resources will be divided or be given to the people justly. If Islam wins, then people will have the freedom. They will not become the slave of money or those who have money, the rich community. So Islam basically comes with the justice, with the freedom, with no racism in Islam. We have all these examples how Bilal, who was an African, was the muadhin, the caller of prayer. He used to call for prayer, giving the adhan. Such a person becoming the caller of the prayer, where Arabs of that time, they used to be angry on such a person. He cannot pronounce the words or letters properly, become a caller of prayer. But Prophet said, no, it is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah likes his voice.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
إلا الله.
CIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The flood of guns from the United States into Mexico is helping to sustain much of the crime, violence, and corruption driving thousands of Mexicans to seek a better life north of the border. We're prepared for an article written jointly by Robert Reich and Edward Helmore. The piece is titled, American Guns Are Flooding into Mexico and Wreaking Havoc. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Even as Republican members of U.S. Congress accuse President Joe Biden of failing to secure the nation's southern border, Mexico is facing a growing problem of securing its northern border. Guns from the United States are pouring into Mexico, arming violent drug gangs. Mexico has tried just about everything to stop the flow of firearms from the north, passing strict gun control laws, imposing stiff penalties on traffickers, and pleading with U.S. authorities to stop the trafficking. But nothing has worked. So now it's doing what any litigious American would do. It's suing. On Wednesday, 4th of August, Mexico announced that it is seeking at least $10 billion in compensation from 11 major U.S. gun manufacturers for the havoc the U.S. guns have wrought south of the border. The lawsuit charges America's gun makers know their products are being trafficked to Mexico and are expressly marketing their weapons to Mexican criminal gangs, designing guns to be easily modified to fire automatically and be readily transferable on the criminal market in Mexico. The deluge of firearms from the United States to Mexico, on average more than 500 every day, is contributing to mayhem there. Killings have become a routine part of the Mexican drug trade. In Mexico's recent midterm election campaign, 30 candidates were gunned down by criminal gangs. In 2019 alone, at least 17,000 homicides in Mexico were linked to trafficked weapons. Yet Mexico's lawsuit is likely to face tough going in the United States, where the easy accessibility of guns is also wreaking havoc, but where gun ownership is considered a constitutional right and gun purchases are skyrocketing. In addition, U.S. gun makers have erected a fortress of legal protections. In 2005, the gun lobby got congressional Republicans to enact the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Firearms Act, banning most lawsuits brought against gun manufacturers from marketing and distributing their products. At a more basic level, American capitalism considers any market to be an opportunity to make a profit. After all, a buck is a buck. Or, more precisely, 19.98 pesos at today's exchange rate. In the United States, buying and selling are hallmarks of freedom. To prohibit a sale is to intrude on the free market. For another government to bar its consumers from buying American goods is to violate free trade. Alejandro Celorio, a legal advisor to Mexico's foreign ministry, estimates the damage to the Mexican economy caused by traffic guns totals 1.7% to 2% of Mexico's gross domestic product, GDP. What's left unsaid is that Mexico's illicit drug business is also a boon to the Mexican economy, adding billions of dollars each year in foreign sales, mostly to American consumers eager to buy thousands of kilos of methamphetamines, heroin, cocaine, and fentanyl each year. Freedom of contract, it's called. We sell them guns that kill them. They sell us drugs that kill us. But this isn't trading goods. It's trading bads. There's death on both sides. The merchants of such death, American gun makers like Glock, Smith & Wesson, Beretta USA, Barrett, Century International Arms, and Colt, Mexican producers of methamphetamines, heroin, and fentanyl, and the wholesalers and traffickers connecting buyers with sellers on both sides of the border are making piles of money. Free market ideologues will argue that as long as everyone is getting what they want, these trades are efficient. Yet vast numbers of people are dying. The U.S. Republicans who protect gun manufacturers and who are criticizing President Joe Biden for failing to secure the southern border from migrants desperate to come to the United States should take note of this tragic irony. The flood of guns from the United States into Mexico is helping to sustain much of the crime, violence, and corruption, driving thousands of Mexicans to seek a better life north of the border in the United States. It's also enabling the flow of dangerous drugs from Mexico across the border that are killing hundreds of thousands of Americans, many in states and congressional districts represented by those same Republicans. Guns, dangerous drugs, and desperate migrants are inextricably connected. The answer to solving one of these problems lies in responding to all three. Moreover, gun sales, which spiked sharply during the early months of the coronavirus pandemic, have continued to increase in the United States, with first-time buyers making up more than one-fifth of Americans who purchase guns. The development will frustrate and disappoint gun control advocates who point out the huge number of firearms already circulating in American society, as well as a seemingly never-ending cycle of mass shootings. Study by the General Social Survey, a public opinion poll conducted by a research center at the University of Chicago, 39% of American households own guns, up from 32% in 2016. Separately, research data compiled by the FBI's National Instant Criminal Background Check System, or NICS, background checks that topped 1 million a week in March of 2020, the highest since the government began tracking them in 1998, and continued with 1 week in April this year recording a record 1.2 million checks. Background checks are seen as a reliable metric to track gun sales. A third data study, compiled by Northeastern University and the Harvard Injury Control Research Center, and seen by the New York Times, shows that 6.5% of American adults, or 17 million people in the United States, have purchased guns in the past year, up from 5.3% in 2019. Of those, almost one-fifth who bought guns last year were first-time gun owners, of whom half were women, a fifth were black, and a fifth were Hispanic. In 2021, gun owners overall were 63% male, 73% were white, 10% were black, and 12% were Hispanic. Separately, the Thrace, a nonpartisan group that tracks gun sales, estimates that 2.3 million guns were purchased in January of this year alone. The group said sales, which had remained largely flat for the duration of the Trump presidency, jumped 64% in 2020. Still, the increases are relatively small compared to the 400 million guns estimated to already be in circulation, including at least 4 million AR-15s, commonly described as assault rifles. South Los Angeles City Council representative Marquise Harris-Dawson told the New York Times, "Americans are in an arms race with themselves," adding, "There was just as much a run on guns as on detergents and cleaners in the beginning of the pandemic." Increased gun sales comes as Texas recently became the 20th state to pass legislation that no longer requires a permit to carry a concealed handgun. At the same time, a rash of mass shootings, often involving AR-15 weapons, have dominated headlines. According to the Gun Violence Archive, 67 mass shootings have taken place in May of this year. The most recent occurred when a gunman opened fire in Miami, Florida, killing two people and injuring 20 others. Authorities in Texas said recently they had arrested a man accused of plotting to carry out a mass shooting at a Walmart store, and a search of the suspect's home turned up firearms, ammunition, and materials officials described as radical ideology paraphernalia. Still, researchers are wary of connecting increased gun ownership with gun violence. The FBI reported a 25% rise in homicides last year that has continued into this, with an 18% increase over the first 3 months of 2021 across 37 cities, including rises of 36% in the city of Los Angeles and 23% in New York City. But criminologist Richard Rosenfeld at the University of Missouri told the New York Times that the focus on gun numbers is misplaced. Richard Rosenfeld said, "The critical issue is not simply the increase in the supply of guns, but in the nature of the weaponry that's being used in violent crime. And that has really changed."
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's new episode of The Lantern here on IRIB English Radio. I personally am so very much for animal cruelty-free products and procedures. I know that scientists sometimes have reason to justify their experiments on animals for the greater good, for the sake of humanity, and stuff like that, but there always should be a line, right? And Islamically speaking, I'm not sure whether that is the objective behind the creation of animals. I'm no scholar. The reason I wanted to open up with that line is because that is in a way related to the short story we're going to hear on today's episode. And let's hear it, our short, interesting little anecdote, and we're going to be right back.
In the name of Allah, Salamun Alaikum, dear friend. Welcome to this episode of Lantern. As you know, we have an interesting story at the beginning of each episode. The title of today's story is Keep Swimming. During a brutal study at Harvard in the 1950s, Dr. Kurt Richter placed rats in a pool of water to test how long they could tread water. On average, they'd give up and sink after 15 minutes. But right before they gave up due to exhaustion, the researchers would pluck them out, dry them off, let them rest for a few minutes, and put them back in for a second round. In this second try, how long do you think they lasted? Remember, they had just swam until failure only a few short minutes ago. How long do you think? Another 15 minutes? 10 minutes? 5 minutes? No, 60 hours. That's not an error. That's right, 60 hours of swimming. The conclusion drawn was that since the rats believed that they would eventually be rescued, they would push their bodies way past what they previously thought impossible. I will leave you with this thought. If hope can cause exhausted rats to swim for that long, what could a belief in yourself and your abilities do for you? Remember what you're capable of. Remember why you're here. Keep swimming.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So basically, the scientist decided to do an experiment on rats and see how long could they keep pushing themselves if in the back of their minds they were assured that eventually they're going to be rescued, right? Now, far be it from me to compare our own lives and our own hardships and difficulties, the ups and downs and obstacles we go through in this world, to that of a bunch of lab rats, but at the end of the day, everything that goes on in this world is a lesson, and we're bound to learn something from it. So if we were to learn something from this scientific experiment, I would say that it kind of reminded me of that line from Finding Nemo. Just keep swimming. Just keep swimming, because at the end of the day, maybe every situation in life could be a sink or swim situation. We already know what the outcome of not swimming could be. You're going to sink. But you don't know what's going to happen if you keep swimming. And that mystery sometimes could be all you need in order to push through the days and make it to tomorrow. A friend of mine once said that her therapist told her that if you just, you don't necessarily have to look forward tomorrow, just look at it with curiosity, and that's one step you can take in order to help yourself carry on, right? Because a lot of us are going through situations, we're going through a phase in our lives that hope seems to be a very distant, unreachable, unavailable notion, and the distress that we are enduring is so profound and so severe that it blocks away every ray of light that could possibly penetrate into our minds where we're standing. From where I'm looking, it's hopeless. And if we are going to look at this whole thing through Islamic lenses, right? Because at the end of the day, Islam is our lifestyle. It's not just this religion that appeared 1400 years ago and something that we no longer feel connected to and we only adhere to when it comes to certain celebrations and rituals and whatnot. Islam is a lifestyle, and if we look at it through this Islamic lens, we can see how profound and significant the concept of hope is within our religion. And looking at this experiment, a whole flood of verses came to my mind, but and a hadith as well. But one of the things that really, you know, made me connect the dots in a way in my head is, I guess this is why the idea of awaiting relief into Dar al-Faraj is so emphasized and so important in our religion. The fact that our ahadith tell us that afdalul ibadah, the best, the highest form of worship, is into Dar al-Faraj, awaiting relief. And this relief can be on a personal level or it can be on a collective, general, public level, right? And often when we talk about Faraj, we associate it with the reappearance of Sahib al-Zaman alayhi salam. May Allah hasten in his reappearance. To think that believing in the idea of Faraj, of that relief, through that divine leader whose heart is filled with compassion for all living things and whose only purpose in life is to come and uphold, establish justice, and make life better for everyone. To believe in that is to know everything is going to be okay. Even if that faraj, that relief, that reappearance doesn't happen in my lifetime, the fact that I know one day it's going to happen. Because my problems, not to sound so harsh, but my problems are not special. I'm not special in that sense. Everyone is going through problems since the beginning of time. But at the end of the day, everyone is going through a struggle, a battle in their lives. And everyone needs for things to turn for the better. Thank you for being with us on this episode of The Lantern. I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.